Shrink Wrap Radio number 279, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, with Francis Weller.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Francis Weller, who is a psychotherapist and author of the 2011 book, Entering the Healing Ground: Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. He's been in private practice since 1983. During that time, he developed a style of working with people called soul-centered psychotherapy. Francis Weller says his approach to working with the wounds and challenges we face restores soul as the primary focus. He says he's come to have a deep faith in the way soul/psyche works, its moods and movements, how it speaks through symptoms and images, how it longs for intimacy with the world and its need for beauty. He says he sees this every day in his work with people. Weller goes on to say we often struggle with the muscular demands of our culture to measure up, perform, and be perfect. This leaves little room for those parts of us that do not match these expectations, the vulnerable, weak, inadequate, and grieving parts of soul. And yet it is precisely these parts of who we are that bring us closer to others, to the vitality of life in the world, bringing these rejected and denied elements of soul life, those places where we've said no to life, back into our daily rhythms is what adds meaning and depth to our days. Francis Weller reports he has worked with many concerns in his practice. He specializes in grief work, shame, addiction, depression, and men's issues. He works with individuals and couples, and he offers groups periodically. Now, here's the interview. Francis Weller, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's good to be here, David.
Well, it's good to be here with you in your office. A lot of the interviews I conduct are over the phone and over Skype, and I always like it when I can be present with a person.
Makes a big difference to be face-to-face.
Yeah, and yeah. You've got such a nice space here that you've created in Santa Rosa, California. Now, you and I have traveled a lot in the same circles over the years. We know a lot of people in common, but we've never spent any real time together. So I welcome this opportunity to get to know you and your work better.
Thank you.
Now, you've just published a new book titled Entering the Healing Ground: Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. And I must say, your writing is very soulful. It's really good. So it supports your topic.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you've been getting some good feedback along those lines.
I have been getting some beautiful feedback.
Yeah, yes. You have. Well, you know, entering the healing ground, grief, ritual, and the soul of the world, it's a big topic, beautifully covered in a rather slim volume. But before we get into your book, let's tell us a bit about your background, your training, and maybe some of the key stepping stones in the evolution of your outlook as a thinker and as a therapist.
Well, I've been practicing for about 30 years.
Okay.
And the original key thinkers were Jung, a big influence on my thought, and then James Hillman.
Okay, also another Jungian.
Another Jungian,
yeah.
And then I was also blessed with some very wonderful mentors. I was licensed very young. I was only 27 years old, and I was smart enough to know I didn't know anything about sitting with people.
I think I remember you at 27 years old.
You probably
or shortly thereafter.
Yes. And I contacted the Jung Institute in San Francisco, and they gave me some names of people. And I met a man named Clark Berry, who was in his mid-60s at the time, mm-hmm. and one of the most generous souls I've ever met. And I always remember the first thing he taught me when we sat face-to-face. He reached over and he patted this big rock he had by his side. He said, "This is my clock. I operate at geologic speed.
Wow.
And if you're going to work with the soul, you need to learn this rhythm, because this is how the soul moves."
Oh.
And that was, you know, 25, 27 years ago.
Wow.
I will never forget that teaching, and I tell every patient I sit with that story, because almost all of them are in a hurry to change.
Yeah.
Because the underlying premise to that is that something's wrong with me and I won't belong, I won't fit in until I fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get them to get out of that fantasy, out of that fixation, yeah, with change and self-improvement is a big part of my work with people.
As opposed to, if they're headed that way, you are headed towards what?
Tracking soul. What does the symptom itself ask from this person? Mm-hmm. The depression, the addiction, the relationship struggles, the loneliness, the feelings of emptiness. These are all symptoms. These are all the ways that the soul is trying to get the attention of the person in their life.
Okay.
And then when we pay attention to that, when we truly listen to what the soul is asking for, the symptoms tend to abate. They haven't improved a damn thing. But nothing needed to be improved.
Uh-huh.
A deepening was being asked for. A listening, a slowing downward, to live at the rhythm of soul rather than the rhythm of the machine, which is what most of us are.
Yeah. So not only a listening, but also I would gather some kind of a deeper self-acceptance.
Yes. Yes. And that's a good comment, because so much, again, of that pressure to change is based on trying to perfect the self, that if I just become good enough, then I'll belong. Another stream that's come into my life a lot is the wisdom of indigenous cultures. I'm going to make some generalizations here, but in many indigenous cultures, it's the job of the community to impress upon the individual that they are somebody worthy of welcome. We've completely turned that around in our culture, where it's up to me to prove to the community,
mm-hmm,
that I'm somebody worthy of being included.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes, yeah, a weight that we carry our entire lifetime.
Mm, yeah.
And so we've created a culture based on appearance, on performance, on specialness, on rank. And these are empty things.
Yeah, I have to remind myself from time to time not to chase after another piece of paper.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
To get certified in this or certified in that, et cetera.
Yeah, we are definitely addicted to some type of proving of ourselves,
mm-hmm,
to the community, that I'm worthy of belonging.
Yeah.
We've forgotten that's a given. You're here.
Right.
You're in this body.
Right.
You know? And that, again, that's part of the grief we carry, is that has not been conferred to us.
I feel that as you say that, I can contact a little bit,
yes,
of that grief,
yes,
of,
yes,
never having really been truly welcomed in, you know, to, like, you've made it.
Right.
A little bit of that, you know, getting my PhD, but pretty short-lived.
Yeah, the achievement basis for belonging is like getting a coin from having done a good job, and you stick it in your pocket, and you think, I'm a wealthy man. You wake up in the morning, the coin is gone. I've got to go out and do it again today,
mm-hmm,
and the next day, and the next day. We spend most of our days trying to prove our worth to the world.
Wow.
And it's an empty cup. It never fills up. There's too many holes in that bucket.
Yeah. Now, maybe this next question relates to that. I gather you didn't go on to become a Jungian analyst.
No.
And why not?
Well, I developed what I call the soul-centered psychotherapy practice. And along with the influences of indigenous cultures, and the third piece of that training, an influence was by a man named Paul Shepherd. I don't know if that's some...
No, I don't recognize the name.
Paul Shepherd died about 10 years ago. He was what he called a human biologist. And he wrote some amazing books like Nature and Madness, Coming Home to the Pleistocene, The Tender Carnivore. And what he was writing about and working on was the idea that it was our evolutionary design to be intimately connected to nature, to be intimately connected to a small group of people, and to have that embedded in the sacred cosmology. And in those three pieces in combination made for healthy human lives,
okay.
Sane lives, mm-hmm. rich lives, rooted in ritual, in mythology, in deep participation and intimacy with the wild surrounds. This book, Coming Home to the Pleistocene in particular, really lays out how the mind evolved, how the body evolved, how our social connections evolved. So those three things, archetypal psychology, indigenous traditions, and Shepherd's ideas have kind of coalesced into how I now do my practice and how I do my teaching.
Yeah, now the indigenous piece, I know that you studied for some time with a man named Maldoma Somme.
Mm-hmm.
Am I pronouncing that?
Maldoma Somme, yes.
Maldoma Somme.
Yes.
And I sort of just know that kind of in a peripheral way. So maybe you can tell us how that came about and what sort of study you did with him.
Well, I met him in 94 and then did a year-long training with him on Ritual Village. He and his partner at the time, Sobhfu Somme, they were married at the time, offered this training in Oakland. And that was one of the first times I actually touched my grief. I mean, I was so well insulated from my own grief. But there's something that happened in the midst of that training that brought up this untouched sorrow of not belonging.
Mm-hmm.
Here I was in a village context where everything was focused on remembering the premises of village life.
Now, he was from Africa.
He is from Africa. He's from Burkina Faso. And he was sent here by his elders to bring the wisdom of indigenous traditions to the West.
Uh-huh.
His name actually means to make friends with the stranger.
Maybe I'm confusing him with someone else. Is he a drummer?
He's a drummer.
He's a drummer as
yeah,
well.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And after after the training was over, we began our conversations about the possibility of bringing our works together.
Mm-hmm.
And so for about 6 years, we taught a lot of programs together, kind of commingling indigenous traditions with Western psychological, poetic, and spiritual traditions,
mm-hmm.
and created this amazing amalgam of what I call the wisdom bridge.
I think I remember seeing flyers and so on, so that's how I sort of know about
mm-hmm.
this. So I kind of regret that I didn't participate now as I'm hearing about this.
Yeah. And that's also where the grief work began. That's where I was first exposed to grief rituals and seeing the power of a community-based process for touching our sorrow, to see dozens of men and women on their knees sobbing together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in our culture, grief is a very private, solitary event. And in even that design leads to feeling ashamed of your grief. You know,
it sounds like the communal part of this is really important. The being with other people who are willing to share and support and go into that space.
Well, grief itself has always been communal. It has never, ever been private in our long history as a species.
So it's pretty private.
It's very private in this culture.
Mainstream culture, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the whole idea of suffering has become very private and interior. It's called private pain. We don't want others to know about it. We show a strong face. We show, the strong body.
Mm-hmm.
We hide our suffering because there's some sense that it leads to evidence of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly for men, weakness is a sin. You cannot reveal weakness.
Right.
So we are left to carry our grief in solitude. I was giving a talk to a group of clergy last fall on grief. And as I began talking and looking around the room, all of a sudden everyone's eyes were wet. So I stopped my talk and I said, "Tell me what's in the room right now." And a man said, "Well, my wife died a few months ago." Another woman said, "Well, my divorce was final 2 weeks ago." Another one, well, my father-in-law just committed suicide. Another one, well, a restaurant in town just closed down, and it was the favorite place for all of us to gather. And I said, okay, now how many of you have a place to take your sorrow? And no one raised their hand.
Hmm.
So here are these leaders of church communities are stuck with private pain.
Yeah.
So the message is so profound in the culture that we cannot have community around us.
Right. If your parent dies, you might get 2 or 3 days off of work.
You might have an hour or so long funeral.
Yeah.
But even the funerals themselves have become so flattened. People end up apologizing for crying at a funeral. Oh, I'm sorry, I lost control. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to attend a number of funerals on my time in Africa, and they spent 3 days on the funeral. So the process itself involves the entire community coming together, and it's the job of the bereaved to let it go. I mean, to throw themselves entirely into the process of weeping. And then they have attendants there to make sure they don't hurt themselves. Then they have drummers behind them and dancers. And they have wailers there to keep the energy moving.
Mm.
And then they have people there witnessing. And then there's a group up on the hill eating and sleeping. And another group just having a few Miller beers, you know, and relaxing.
I think some of that has survived in African-American culture.
It has.
A much more comfortable showing that kind of emotion and grief.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So having that begin to become part of what we're restoring here has been amazingly healing for people.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 3 grief rituals to show my first tear. I knew I had a ton of grief, but I had to keep going back because I couldn't quite crack that veneer.
There's resistance. I mean, I found resistance in myself even to reading your book. You know, like, oh, do I want to read this book about grief and sorrow and all kinds of heavy down stuff?
But grief is incredibly alive. It is so vital and has nothing to do with deadness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's our perception.
Yes.
That grief is kind of a deadening state. But grief is really the expression of what I've loved. It's an affirmation that something has pierced me, has touched my heart, and has had an effect on my life, and now it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So what should be my response to that?
Yeah.
Numbness? Dissociation? Denial? Avoidance? Distraction?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the cultural response.
Yeah.
But what the soul wants is to fully express what that relationship, that presence, that place meant to me.
Yeah.
And that is grief.
I'm remembering the movie Zorba the Greek.
Yes.
And that had such a big impact on me and everybody, I think, whoever saw that film. And I'm remembering both the wonderful depiction of joy, of getting freed up, and also the depiction of grieving in that part of the world where the women are just shrieking and wailing. They even have, I think, paid mourners.
Yes, yes.
To help facilitate.
That's right.
They're grief facilitators, I guess.
That's right, yeah. Well, we think that grief and joy have no relationship, but they are intimately connected. William Blake had a wonderful phrase. He said, the deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy. So if we cut off our access to grief, what happens to our access to joy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens is the emotional field compresses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I call living. We live in a flatline culture.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, that flatline is really what happens when the range of our expected emotional life is shrunken.
Mm-hmm.
And we're left with the barest range of feeling states. So we rely upon excitement. Stimulation, stimulants, to feel like we have a pulse.
Okay.
So we need bungee jumping and, you know, race cars and
drug addiction,
you know, something that actually gets us to feel like we're alive.
Yeah.
We've lost that range.
Uh-huh.
And that the depth of that experience is as important as the height of that experience. We've got to stretch that back out.
Wow.
In fact, at every grief ritual that I've led, it ends in this ecstatic joy. I mean, it's shocking what happens.
Yeah.
We enter into this place of such sorrow But where we end up is in this place of giddy delight. It's astonishing what happens when the heart is, for a moment, released of its weight.
Yeah.
It makes room for this feeling of gratitude and joy. In fact, in our work, I teach that it is the mark of the truly mature human being that they carry grief in one hand and gratitude in the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that to deny either one of them diminishes the range of our life. If you deny grief and you only live with gratitude, you lack a certain depth. You lack the tempering that opens your heart to compassion. If you deny gratitude and only live in grief, that's a sorrowful world, which leads to cynicism, bitterness, withdrawal. So the human being needs to really be able to embrace both of those and be stretched to your maximum, holding both of those things simultaneously.
That's one of the things that I like about the Jungian orientation, is that it also stresses the ability to live with opposites, to hold things that might on the face of it seem incompatible.
Right, right. And
it kind of recognizes the full complexity of the human dilemma.
Yes, the full catastrophe.
Yeah, the full catastrophe.
As Zarma would say.
Exactly.
Yes.
You know, in your book, you talk about the five gates of grief.
And yes.
Maybe that would be a good place for us to go, to have you take us through those five gates, if you will.
Those slowly evolved over time, sitting with many, many circles of people in grief. The first gate is one we're all familiar with. It's to lose someone or something that we love.
Okay.
So we lose a partner. We lose a child, which is just devastating.
Yeah.
A parent, a friend. We lose a home through foreclosure. We move away from a place that was just precious to us because of a job. We lose a job. You know, these things really are familiar and deep, and they reside in us. Then when we lose them, we feel grief.
Yeah.
That's the one grief that's acknowledged in the culture. The other four gates of grief are basically untouched and ignored.
Well, before we leave this one,
yes.
Because loss often triggers depression. I remember losing one romantic relationship along the way that really triggered a pretty deep depression in me. What's the relationship between grief and depression? And I guess that's the question.
Many people who come to see me come in with the symptoms of depression. What I find sitting with them for not very long is that what they really are doing is living with the oppressive weight of untouched grief.
Mm-hmm.
So when we begin to unpack the sorrows that they carry, the depression typically resolves. So it's almost a misdiagnosis at times. These losses that you're mentioning frequently are carried again privately.
Yeah.
You know, and so we don't have the access to a communal process to really work that grief down to the ground. So it's what we end up, what I call recycling our grief. Where we, let me back up. There's two things required to fully release grief. There's containment and release. The containment is the field within which you can pour your grief. Typically that's supplied by the village, by the community, by your friends. My job then is just to pour the grief to the ground. If I'm carrying it privately, I have to do two jobs simultaneously. I have to be containment and release, and guess which one wins out?
Containment. Mm-hmm.
So then I'm never allowed full release. So I cry alone, I weep alone, but it's almost like it goes out, but it comes right back in. It does not have the full cycle of expression and release. Because the containment's not there, I can't fully let go to it. So we have long periods, prolonged, even in the diagnostic and statistical manuals, complicated grief. Well, how do we get to have complicated grief? Except for the fact, primarily, that we didn't have the support we needed to really drop into the grief and fully immerse ourselves in it adequately to move through it.
So have you never found that by involving someone in grief work that it triggered a depression?
Symptomatically, sure. There will be symptoms of depression, which are oftentimes secondary pieces of an unlived life. You know, pieces of their own soul life that haven't been fulfilled, haven't been acknowledged. To lose a partner, like you just described, you know, may trigger off the fact that I have not risked in my life, that I haven't, that I've lived a very careful life, that I've been cautious with my heart. So that it may trigger a secondary grief that needs to be tended, which may first appear under the symptoms of depression, and that depression is again a voice of the soul calling our attention to that place. This has not been touched, which is primarily, that's the second gate of grief. Shall we go there?
Yeah, let's go to okay. The second gate.
The second gate of grief is, so if the first gate was losing something or someone we love, the second gate has to do with losing something that has never really known love, some part of ourself that's never really been touched by love. For instance, many of us were told as we're growing up that our anger wasn't welcomed, or our sexuality wasn't welcomed, mm-hmm. or our sadness wasn't welcomed, or our exuberance wasn't welcomed.
Right.
And those things were shunted to the what Jung would call the shadow, what I call the wasteland. Mm-hmm. These are losses to the integrity of the psyche. Any loss should be acknowledged by grief, but we cannot grieve for what we hold contempt for. So we're stuck. We live with this persistent, untouched sorrow for these pieces that we've lost and have not been able to grieve over. So a lot of the work in here, in my office, but also in the grief rituals, is to begin to put our arms around these pieces that have been lost to us, bring them back, and to weep for them, to make amends. Mm-hmm. That I've treated parts of myself with so much cruelty, hatred, you know, shame. And to bring them back is a big part of that second gate of work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel a sense of loss around music.
Uh-huh.
That I was not given or forced. My grandmother tried to force me to learn to play piano, and she said, David, you're going to regret this for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, that script somehow got in pretty deep, because, in fact, I have regretted it. I've tried to learn piano as an adult, and you know, I got a little ways, but I just really couldn't get to the level that mm-hmm. that would be fully satisfying. So I feel real grief about that.
Yeah.
Is this part of gate two?
It certainly can be that somehow the message was given to you, either you weren't good enough or that it would be a waste of time. So some aspect of your own, what would bring you vitality, what would bring you alive, mm-hmm. was cut off.
Yeah, it wasn't silence. So much that I got a negative message about it. It just didn't happen. You know, right. I probably needed somebody to say, okay, I know many people hate the fact that they were forced to study music. I sort of wish that I had either had a way to have been welcomed into it mm-hmm. so that I would have loved it, because there's a place in me that feels very musical, or that I'd been forced so that at least I would have those tools to call upon at this stage of my
right,
life.
Right. So there's grief.
Yeah.
And how do you carry that grief? How do you acknowledge that grief?
Yeah.
Now that's a good question.
Well, telling you about it right now, that's one way.
Yeah.
But it's something I have spoke about and shared with friends
mm-hmm.
And tried to remediate, as I say, by taking music lessons with all kinds of different instruments and
mm-hmm.
still having fantasies. You know,
mm-hmm.
a didgeridoo, all you have to, it's just got basically one or two notes.
Uh-huh.
I tried that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
I don't mean to.
No, it's fine. The third gate of grief is the sorrow of the earth. That is around us all the time. Pablo Neruda had a line, I know the earth and I am sad. This sorrow, I wrote about in the book, the impact that the Gulf of Mexico oil spill had on me.
Yes.
How I would wake in the middle of the night hearing dolphins screaming, you know, and just feeling the death that was happening to thousands and thousands of birds and turtles, and it just pierced me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Gulf is, 3,000 miles away from me.
Yeah.
But that sorrow was touching my soul, as it was, I think, for this entire country. It was impacting us. The sorrows of the earth are with us all the time. When we do the grief rituals, invariably there are many people who speak to loss of wetlands, the death of the salmon, the clear cuts of the forest near their homes, clearing away acreage that used to be wild for more grapes. These are lost.
Urban blight.
Or
strip
urban
malls.
Yes, strip malls. These are all sorrows that befall the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have some fantasy that we're separate from that, we are not. What happens to the earth is felt in our tissue every day. One of the most powerful examples of that was when I was leading a ritual called Renewing the Earth, which is we do this ritual every year. It's our attempt to put something back into her belly, because we're such an extractive culture. We take, we take, we take, and we place nothing back into her body. And I was planning to drum for that ritual, and I began by saying an invocation. But the moment I was done saying the prayer, I was on my knees, and I wept for 4 hours. As we named, we begin that ritual at the funeral. We build a funeral pyre, and we put onto the funeral pyre all the things that have left the earth this year. It could be very personal things like family members, or but also then cultural things like democracy, you know, mercy, you know, kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And then we name, you know, manatees, and, you know, everything that was being put on this funeral pyre was just hitting me like a body blow.
Wow.
And that was one of the first times I really got that this is something we are all experiencing all the time, but we are very good at keeping it at bay.
I think so. And I think, I mean, could it be argued that this is a defense mechanism that makes some kind of sense, because otherwise we might just feel so overwhelmed as to
throw
in the towel?
Yeah, it makes sense in the absence of community ritual. It makes sense in the absence of things that would help us hold this. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of the defense mechanisms we have are the results of what we've lost. You know, Jung called neurosis illegitimate suffering. Well, we're going to suffer. No way around that.
Yeah.
But if we're given what we need to support us in our experience of loss and death and suffering, we're okay. But in the absence of that, we have to erect amazing strategies of disconnection, of avoidance, of numbness, of anesthesia. All of these are strategic moves to cope with something that is missing, which is the fourth gate of grief.
Before we go there, something that's coming up for me is, I read it in the paper just this morning, you may have seen it too, in the Press Democrat, talking about that consumers have lost confidence in the economy, and that we're doing worse than we might need to because of this kind of psychological loss of confidence. And what occurs to me as I hear you speaking here is that, in a way, this could be a kind of unseen accumulation of all of these various assaults, not just to the economy. Certainly there was this major economic assault of a sense of betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But the whole world got betrayed by the some crazy manipulations of the economy. So we're all carrying that grief at some level.
Absolutely.
As well as the Gulf, as well as the nuclear disaster in Japan.
Yes.
And we try to put these things out of our mind, but somewhere they're there, lurking, and maybe affecting even something like consumer confidence.
Right, right. No, I think it's a very good point, Dave. I think we are a culture saturated in grief, and we don't know what to do with it.
Hmm.
After 9/11, I was in New York about a month after the trade towers were destroyed. My son had just started going to school at Sarah Lawrence. And we went out there to see him. And he took me downtown, as close as you could get to where everything had happened. And what I saw was quite extraordinary. Grief shrines everywhere. Photos, candles, flowers. People gathering in parks in small circles. Some singing, some silent, some doing ritual. It's as if the soul had an elemental need to come together, to touch these things, to move towards grief together, communally. Unfortunately, that was not our collective response. Shortly after that, we were told to go shopping. And then we went to war. So that initial response of sorrow and grief quickly became silenced and suppressed. And we went back to our business.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, what lingers in us is this unresolved grief.
Right, right. Another thing that gets triggered, there's an ad that appears in the paper that really irritates me. It's got this phrase that says, shop brilliantly.
Mm.
Shop brilliantly. Mm. Talk about a message of consumerism. If you're going to be showing your brilliance by going to the mall and shopping.
Well, one of the things we talk about in the work that I do is that we need to restore what I call primary satisfactions. The things that we evolved with over hundreds of thousands of years that satisfy the soul at the most basic level. Adequate levels of touch. You know, comforting in times of sorrow and loss. Celebration and gratitude. Gathering food together. Eating together under the stars. Telling stories around a campfire. You know, laughing and playfulness together, sensuous, erotic connection to the wider world. These are what made us human. And for the most part, these things have disappeared. Mm-hmm. Now we are left with secondary satisfactions, material goods, seeking power, rank, prestige, addictions. And these things never satisfy the soul.
Yeah.
So they actually produce a hunger. So in some ways, this lack of consumer satisfaction, I find to be very comforting. That maybe we're not going to continue to be stupefied by buying the next thing, but maybe we are beginning to look to see how are we doing with one another? How are our communities doing? How are the children? How are the generations that are going to follow us going to fare?
Yeah, I've been looking at the child piece in some recent interviews. Just a couple days ago, I interviewed Jill Bakken, the fellow who wrote the book The Corporation and also produced that film, which you may
have
seen.
Yes, I have.
And he's written a book about the corporate influence on childhood. And I've been reflecting with people lately, remembering the childhood that I grew up with, you know, which probably already was far from the ideal, but, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, a city, but I could get on a bicycle as a young kid and ride my bike miles and miles
mm-hmm.
away from home.
Mm-hmm.
I have grandchildren growing up now, and they can't leave their yard.
Yeah.
And that's how it is for most kids.
Yes.
Parents are not comfortable with the kids leaving the yard. They'll take them to all kinds of activities to try to keep them busy and occupied, but they don't feel fundamental safety.
Fourth gate of grief.
Okay. Are we in the fourth? Have we done the fourth?
We have not done the fourth gate.
Okay, let's name the first three again and then name the
first three again, the loss of someone or something that we love.
Okay.
Those places within us that have never known love. The sorrow of the earth. The fourth gate is, it's a hard one to really describe, but I find it always present when we gather together in ritual space. When we arrived here on the planet, we came wired for a certain expectation. All the things I just named, you know, touch, laughter,
yeah.
play, comforting in times, all those things, we were wired for that whole mm-hmm. symphony of humanity. We expected to get up in the morning and walk out and see 40 pairs of eyes looking back at us and asking us, what did you dream last night? Come, let's go get water. You know, we expected that. That's our entire wiring. But none of that materialized. So there's this fog, this absence in our psyche. And the worst part about it is we typically blame ourselves for this absence. Because we expected it on some level, yeah. even unconsciously.
Yeah.
Its absence is perceived as a flaw.
Or we see ads, Budweiser ads of people, you know, on TV. They're having a great time.
Great time, great time.
They're having a great sense of community.
That's right.
And, geez, how come that's
what's
not
wrong with
for me?
Yeah, what's wrong with me? Yeah. Paul Shepherd, that I mentioned before, he had a brilliant line once. He was being interviewed by Derek Jensen. And I can't remember the question, but Shepherd's response was, the grief and sense of loss that we often attribute to a failure in our personality is actually a feeling of emptiness where a beautiful and strange otherness was meant to be experienced. It's a brilliant phrase.
Mm-hmm.
We expected to encounter something beautiful and strange and other, you know, wildness and even in each other a certain wildness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we've become quite domesticated and quite tame and very cautious and very careful. And that wildness comes out now in very shadowy ways. Violence. You know, warfare. So that fourth gate is always present too as a background echo in our life that something fundamental is missing. Some sense of belonging that I anticipated is absent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the cause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're doubly punished in a sense. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, the absence is already there, and then I feel somehow that's my fault that this did not materialize.
Where's my larger family?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, when we gather in these circles, there's something so familiar about it. Jung had a phrase once called that we, the unforgotten wisdom. At the core of the psyche. Unforgotten wisdom. So some deep memory echo in us that when we're provided what we expected, some part of us recognizes it, even if we've never tasted it before. So people have never come to these grief rituals to go, that was oddly familiar, even though I've never done anything like that before in my life.
Yeah.
Some part of the psyche recognizes what just transpired. Because we're wired for ritual. We're wired to be in community that way. We're wired to lean into each other to show what is most vulnerable and what is most intimate with other human beings.
You know, years ago I had some experience of that in the encounter group movement.
Yes.
And it wasn't so much conceived around this issue of grief, but certainly it's, I think many of the same things transpired one way or another, that people would put something out that was painful and then find some acceptance in the group, and they would work through their resistance and the group would kind of be prodding, come on, show us who you are, kind of thing. And I remember the first couple of times I went through something like that, I felt like a newborn child.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And went out to be it was a little obnoxious in a way, because you'd come out of that experience and start encountering people that hadn't gone through it. I remember going up to somebody, you know, and saying, hey, we've never really talked. How are you? Or who are you?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're kind of going, whoa, what is this?
Mm-hmm. You're breaking a lot of laws here,
yeah.
A lot of rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of that domestication. We don't know how to meet each other in what is most genuine and raw at times.
And the result, also the phenomenon, and maybe you run into this too in the workshops that you do, but we discovered that there was a sort of post-encounter group low where it would kind of wear off and the person would feel kind of depressed and at a loss. And it was probably because of that encounter with the everyday culture in which there was no support for the insight, the new way of being?
Yes, I'll answer that in two ways. One of them is that, I used the phrase before, primary satisfactions. When we're together in a community space like that, we are living inside of primary satisfaction, temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while we were primarily satisfied, but now I go back into my solitary world, watching TV at night, or sending an email,
mm-hmm.
but I'm back into my solitude. The soul then carries with it its echo of longing. Longing is the memory of having tasted, been inside of primary satisfaction. The other thing we try to do is make sure we have enough repetition of this ritual process.
Yeah.
I don't like doing one-shot deals.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, nothing I teach, any program, I don't do anything as a drive-by event, you know, where you come by and it's kind of cool and intense, and then I'll catch you later. I don't want to do that.
Uh-huh.
I want repetition. Repetition is, what's her name? An anthropologist, Helen Thompson, I can't remember, I'm getting her name wrong, but she said repetition is a form of permanence. That's why even in very intact indigenous cultures, those rituals are happening all the time. Why would they need to? If it's an intact village, you'd think they already know that they belong. But even their repetition of ritual process is the means whereby the stitches are reinforced all the time, that we are a part of one another, that we belong. Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan Indian from the Pacific Northwest, in their language, they say that we are of one skin. That's a beautiful image. Imagine if you knew that you had a shared skin with the rest of the village, and that whatever happened to you, David, everyone would know about, and everyone would be there to respond to it. Again, we go back to, it's my private pain. It's my private event.
Yeah.
I have to cope with
yeah.
it, fix it, and then maybe I can come back and be welcome.
Yeah. Now, some people might think that you're romanticizing indigenous life.
It's hard. I mean, I would not want to live. What I'm trying to do is understand the values that are traditional. These indigenous values have meaning to us. Reciprocity, mutuality, gratitude, you know, restraint. These values have survival in them. These cultures have survived, like the Kalahari Bushmen, at least 75,000 to 125,000 years.
Wow.
How come?
Hmm.
And their possessions are, you know, bow and arrow, a loincloth, and an ostrich egg to carry water. No iPads. No.
No.
You know, and Lawrence Vanderpost described them as the happiest people on the planet.
Yeah.
Because they live inside of primary satisfactions. But life is hard. You know, so there are values that are innate in these cultures that allow them to survive. We're struggling for a breath after only 500 years on this continent. You know, we're something's off in the value structures of our culture. You know, individualism, greed, you know, self as God, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, advancement, achievement. They're not bad values, but we're missing the values of sustainability. We're missing the values that would help us to endure and to remember what the soul actually requires to survive.
Mm-hmm. The fifth gate.
That's what I call
it. If we can handle
another one. The fifth gate is what I call ancestral grief. And ancestral grief is the grief that we carry in several different ways. One of them is our ancestors left something to come here. Oftentimes a lot of hardship. But they also left a context that had survived for thousands of years. All of us come from an indigenous culture. All of us, every single one of us. That survived. That made it. That had its own rituals, its own myths, its own songs, its own prayers, its own food, its own, you know, embeddedness in a geography, in a locale, that was lost. When they came here, many of our ancestors stopped their language. They certainly didn't practice the rituals. These things began to be silenced in an effort to fit in and to acculturate. Made sense, but it's a loss. Another part of ancestral grief, I think of many families I've worked with in here, the coping then with that loss led to rage, to alcoholism, disappearance. You know, they would just leave. So there's this lingering grief of the injuries to and the shame that was part of the loss. I don't know if I'm making sense.
What about joining cults? Is that maybe in an attempt? Cults is always relative, but is that maybe in an attempt to recreate or find or discover that place that's been lost?
I think the longing for belonging is so core to our being that we will almost do anything to establish some rudimentary experience of that feeling state. Mm-hmm. We will betray ourselves to end up having some, at least some pseudo sense of belonging to something. So yes, we will do that almost in a heartbeat, because we can't bear an existence that is so solitary that there's no promise of belonging. That's a fundamental need of the psyche.
You know, I'm thinking of a paradox about the Jungian approach. On the one hand, he talks about the collective and the collective unconscious. On the other hand, he talks about individuation. So it seems like there's a real strong thread there of you've got to go deep inside yourself to discover and achieve your full self. And is there something left out there?
Well, he also said that the soul cannot become itself without an other, which is always found in a you. So individuation, yes. I love the inner work of people that I spend time with. The spontaneous explosion of imagery and dream and intuition, it's beautiful, but it's not complete. You know, and I tell everybody I work with, you know, work in here can take you so far. Then you're going to need community. You know, he also said, you know, marriage is the fastest horse to individuation.
Right.
So it's the intense engagement with others that actually does the work of individuation. It isn't such a solitary thing as it's kind of laid out to be. Mm-hmm. There's a tribe in South Africa that says, "I am because we are." You know, that, and I think that's also, if you dug deep enough into Jung, I think you'd find that's the truth. Mm-hmm. That I am because we are. I become myself in the container of intimacy, in the container of relationship, not in my solitude. In fact, there's a phrase from the alchemist Sendivogius who said, the greater part of the soul lies outside the body. So you and I are connecting right now because there's an overlap of soul right now. We are meeting in a soul place. Intimacy and self-awareness is an in-between experience. It isn't a private one.
Right, right. You
know? It's where we meet.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a point of discovery, of revelation.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm so captivated by what you're saying that I've lost track of whether we've gone through the fifth gate yet or not.
Adequately, you know. Yeah, we can talk more about that, but I think there's a few other things you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, well, you know, we've touched on so many things without me even needing to look at some of the questions that I had thought about. And so, you know, I think we probably covered most of it. Maybe one thing that I do want to touch on. Oh yeah, do you know Edward Tick and his book War and the Soul?
I've read an interview with him. I haven't read that book, but I really like what he's attempting
to
do.
Yeah, I think you guys are. Much on the same page.
Yes,
he's worked with veterans of war, mm-hmm. and brought in some kind of Native American traditions and tried to restore the sense of well, the warrior. There is, you know, that is, there is the archetypal experience of the warrior, and also the Lakota sun dance ceremony, where people kind of take on the grief of the tribe.
Right. Right. Yeah, our work is frequently when we're done with the ritual, I'll often quote the Dalai Lama, who said the next Buddha would not come as an individual but as a community. And we are now the shamans, we are the healers, we are the Buddha. The community is it. We will not find our healing in solitude any longer. We must bring it here. This is the container for our work.
So what's your message then to listeners who are sitting alone somewhere and they're listening to this interview? They might be in their car, they might be working in the garden or off running. I hear people tell me what they're doing, and it's quite a range. They might be at work.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they supposed to find this community?
Well, my hope is they have at least one friend. And if they can, to sit with that friend and just sit down with them and say, today I feel sad. I am carrying great sorrow for my children. I'm carrying great sorrow for our community. I'm carrying great sorrow for our country right now. We seem to be lost. We don't know where we're going. I carry so much sorrow for the Arctic. And the polar ice caps are melting, and the polar bears are drowning. I carry so much sorrow in my body, and I have not spoken it to anyone. And so I'm daring to speak it to you today. Can you hear me? Can you sit with me? Can you tell me your sorrows? And maybe we can bring in another friend. And maybe the three of us can sit together even quietly and say a prayer, and then maybe we could pour our grief into a communal bowl. And then we can offer that as nutrients for the trees and for the plants that need our water. So just to begin, we need to become ritually literate again. You know, that's a great form of illiteracy in this culture. We don't know how to gather and address our communal sorrows or our individual sorrows. So just to begin to take risks, to try to find ways to expose and reveal what you've been told to carry privately. Don't believe that story any longer. We will die in that place. We are dying in that place. We need to come together and begin to speak the deep truths of our life. And the irony is, when we do, we find our joy again. We find our vitality restored. There was a short little poem by Denise Levertov. She said, to speak of sorrow works upon it, moves it from its crouched place, barring the way to and from the soul's hall. So unless we speak of sorrow, the pathway to our soul is blocked, is congested. We need to remember how to speak of sorrow, to touch the soul, and in that place recover beauty, recover intimacy, recover our deep belonging to all things. We come home.
Francis, I think that's a great place for us to wrap it up.
Thank you so much for this time, David. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, we could go on and on. We really could. So, Francis Weller, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, David.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with local therapist Francis Weller. I'm so glad that our mutual friend, Larry Robinson, who I interviewed way back in my first year of podcasting, recommended that I review Francis's book and interview him. I was very quickly drawn into his warmth and immediacy despite my initial resistance to getting into the topic of grief. I hope that the sense of connection and spontaneity that arose between us came through on this recording. Actually, I had a brush with grief after I got home and discovered that the iPhone app I was using to make the recording had developed a glitch. such that I couldn't see the list of recordings on the device and had no way of retrieving the one with Francis, even though I had been very careful to listen back to a portion right after the interview to make certain it was recorded. I felt certain that it was still on the iPhone somewhere and was able to contact the software developer the next day and with their help found the file and got it safely off the iPhone. I managed not to go into full panic over this, trusting that I'd be able to get some tech support and somehow retrieve the file. But nevertheless, I didn't sleep too well that night, as you can imagine. So another source of grief in my life, and maybe yours too, is that I often find myself needing to use technology that I don't completely understand and am not completely in control of. Anybody know what I'm talking about here? I feel lucky to have such a treasure as Francis right in my own backyard, so to speak. After the interview, he shared with me that his book, which we discussed in the interview, is actually a chapter in a much larger book that he's been working on. So we have that to look forward to as well. It's ironic, or perhaps adventitious, or maybe synchronistic, that this topic popped onto my radar when I've been tracking positive psychology so closely in recent episodes. I suppose it helps to right the balance. I'm thinking of the blind men and the elephant, and it seems to me that grief and gratitude and joy and faith and optimism and thriving and tragedy and so on are each parts of the elephant. At least that's how I'm holding it. Thanks once again to Tom Carroll for that old-time Key to the Highway, one of my blues favorites. Are you still out there, Tom? I haven't heard from you in a while. I'm excited to announce that the first of four CE courses, that's continuing education courses, on Jungian psychology is now available through the Zur Institute. You can earn 6 continuing education units just by listening to my series of interviews on Jungian Psychotherapy Part 1, Understanding the Jungian Worldview. So, psychologists, marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, counselors, nurses, and more all have approval for earning CE units. And this course is based on listening to 7 of my past Jungian interviews. You've probably already listened to them. All you need to do after listening is pass a simple true-false test. The cost for the 6-unit course is only $59. You don't even have to be a licensed professional who needs CE units. Perhaps you're an interested amateur or student who'd like to have a certificate to hang on your wall affirming your passion and study. And as you may already know, I have 2 other courses up at the Zur Institute. There's a 4 CE unit course on dreams and a 6 CE unit course on positive psychology. And the easiest way to get to these courses is by going to shrinkwrapradio.com and clicking on the store tab. And then you'll find a link that will take you directly to the right place at the Zur Institute. So I'm really pleased to be able to offer this to my audience. There is a new interview on my other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Barbara Okun, PhD, and Joseph Nowinski, PhD, on family grief. It's a fascinating exploration of how families can find renewal through loss. Inasmuch as today's podcast with Frances Weller was about grief, the Wise Counsel interview with Okun and Nowinski is synchronistically a good companion piece. And let me remind you that you can order their book, Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss, by Barbara Okun and Joseph Nowinski, at thebookdepository.com. In fact, you can order all your books there at great discounts and with free shipping. And if you'll click on their banner in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, then you'll also be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio. And of course, I do hope you'll tangibly support Shrink Wrap Radio with your financial donations if you haven't already done so. As I mentioned previously, I'm putting in at least 10 hours a week to bring each of these Shrink Wrap Radio episodes to you. While there are many psychic rewards for this work, I could really use a raise from the approximately $7 an hour in current donations. So my new rallying cry is, let's give Dr. Dave a raise. Yay!
Hi everybody, I'm Michelle, undergraduate student at Stockholm University. And guys, you are listening to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Michelle, at the University of Stockholm, for that lovely transition. I don't know if all that applause was for me or for you. Now here are some email and posted comments from our listener community. First, we hear from John, who posted a comment about the Martin Seligman keynote that I played. And John writes, Dr. Seligman is a genuine curmudgeon. That's being polite. His successful attraction of scarce resources to his sunshine philosophy will set back psychology for a generation. So far, he has established that humans are very resilient. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that has studied successful species. Resilience is just another bell curve. The positive psychology movement attracts funds, as Dr. Seligman confesses, because it feels good. It's not a cure for mental illness. In fact, it is another way of ignoring the serious mental diseases that continue to plague humans. We don't chain schizophrenics anymore, but we choose to assign them to a dark corner of pill popping so we can enjoy our marvelous resilience. Although a lot of Jung was self-indulgent shamanism, he got one thing right. Individuation, brutal self-awareness, is the key to a successful life with or without happiness. The problem with Dr. Seligman's premise is that it gives only lip service to the fact that resilience correlates with personality factors that have a strong genetic component. Like most bell curves, 60 to 70% of people are resilient. Good for those who are genetically predisposed to be resilient. But there are people at the left side of the curve that need to be aware of their tendency to magnify their discomfort by turning their inconvenience into a horrific tragedy. Maslow's description of the self-actualizing person was an earlier attempt to force a model of healthy behavior on everyone. People have a tendency of taking an idea like resilience and torturing themselves with all sorts of techniques and practices to produce the ideal state. Resilience is natural to the right side of the curve. The left side is apt to feel guilty because they never seem to be able to achieve it. The naturally resilient majority can take care of themselves. There remains the need to take care for those who live their lives in darkness, even though the sun is shining. That's where the millions of dollars need to be spent. John, thanks so much for that critique. Sometimes I get swept up in the enthusiasm of positive psychology, and you know, there is a dark side, and I appreciate your posting in the comments area on the site about that. Next, we hear from Joe Down Under, who writes, "Hi, David. I just wanted to let you know that I have ordered a book using the link on your website." That's the link to the book depository. She says, "So when it filters through to your affiliate account, you should see a few pennies there. Your affiliation did influence my purchase because although there were some slightly cheaper offers, the combination of Book Depository's quality of service and my willingness to support Shrink Wrap Radio won me over. It seems that Amazon will be able to reopen its affiliate program again soon, so you will have another option for a button on your site. Best wishes from Joe." And it was Joe, actually, who turned me on to the Book Depository. And so far, she might be the only user. There might be one other person who's used it. So, hey, folks, take a tip from Joe and go and order your books at the Book Depository by clicking on the link on our site. Next, we hear from Tom on the Isle of Man, who writes, "Hello, I've emailed a couple of times now, still keeping up to date with the great podcast. I'm a designer. I just thought I'd email you regarding this. If you need any design work, promotional material, or anything, just let me know. All my work can be seen on my website at www.xtidesign.com. I don't mean to email this with the intention of making money. As a favor for your work, I'm happy to help with any promotional material for free. Regards, Tom." And Tom, thanks so much for that generous offer. I'll have to put my head to the task of figuring out if there's any design work I can use your help with, but I really do appreciate that generous offer of support. And so I'd like the world to know about your work and your availability. So once again, if you need some design work, you might check out Tom at www.xtidesign.com. Let's see, the next one comes from Simon, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, every time you've reminded us that we could make a donation, I've been listening on the iPod in the car. And by the time I've gotten home, I'm thinking about other things. But finally, I remember to make a donation, and hopefully not the last. I'd like to say a huge thanks for all your effort in sharing Shrink Wrap Radio with us. It truly is a wonderful resource, and your generosity in sharing it should be applauded. Warm regards, Simon." And we heard applause, actually, for that. Thanks, Simon, for that. And thanks for encouraging other people to support us financially as well. And here's one more last one from Ite. I hope I'm saying that right, Ite. That came to me via Facebook. And Ite writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've heard in a recent episode that you accept friend requests from listeners. I discovered Shrink Wrap Radio about a year ago, and I thought it would be cool to drop a line to say that I've been enjoying many of its episodes during my regular runs along the coastline of Tel Aviv, and occasionally also Paris, Copenhagen, and Barcelona." Geez, that makes me feel like I'm running along with you and I'm being in all these wonderful places. He goes on to say, or maybe she, I'm not sure, "I don't know if the psychology talks make the 20K plus runs bearable or the other way around, but the combination works great for me. I'm currently training for the Chicago Marathon, which is exactly in a month from now. And once again, I find myself amazed by the extreme state of concentration, auto-suggestion, and open-mindedness that long runs can get me into. Being in that state while listening to your show is especially helpful, not only in planting new ideas and thoughts, but also in dealing better with my everyday. And I'm talking especially about professional and interpersonal relations at work. I co-founded a software company 4 years ago, and work is indeed the most intense, but at the same time, also most rewarding front in my life. Also, having heard that you seek people to help you with transcriptions, I would love to help with a recent interview that especially inspired me, the one with Dr. Ofer Zur, which coincided with my 26th birthday. Hope you're enjoying your weekend, Ite. So I'm so glad to learn about you out there, Ite, and thank you for your kind offer to transcribe that interview with another fellow from Israel, Dr. Ofer Zur of the Zur Institute that I was talking about earlier. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Francis Weller for his soulful exploration of the importance of grief and ritual. I've still not heard back from Dr. Richard Davidson on my recording of his keynote at the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology. So failing a reply, I'll be checking back in with my good friend Jerry Trumbull with a cautionary update on his explorations of hypnagogia and lucid dreaming. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.